I'm Chris Busby. I'm an international expert on the health effects of ionizing radiation, which I've studied extensively since about 1994. I suppose you would say it's my life's work, my later life's work. And because I've been so successful in persuading scientific community, I suppose, or the world, that ionizing radiation from internal exposures like uranium and cesium-137 and plutonium and all that stuff, that these exposures are extremely hazardous and they're not adequately described by the current radiation model that's used to underpin legislation for exposure. Because I've been so successful at that, I've been sort of airbrushed out of the media. I mean, for example, in the period from about 2000 to 2011 or 12, I suppose, when Fukushima happened, I had front pages in most of the major newspapers, including newspapers in the United States and in France and in Europe, and I gave evidence to the Royal Society, and I was on two British government committees, one looking at uranium weapons, depleted uranium, the other one looking at the health effects of internal radiation. I was matey with the Environment Minister, Michael Meacher, the late Michael Meacher, and I became the scientific secretary of the European Committee on Radiation Risk. Lots and lots of other fancy stuff, but you won't see much of me now. Certainly in the printed media, and pretty much also on the Google and other search engines, because I've been airbrushed. But anyway, that sort of means that I'm right. Well, it means I've been shaking the right tree. And in terms of scientific papers, peer review scientific publications, and so on, I've been increasingly successful in the last 5 or 6 years. And now, if you put in questions about what I've done to AI, and actually in passing, I see AI as a great leap forward. You'll find that AI certainly likes me, and AI says that I've done all sorts of really, really good things. In fact, I'm going to take AI comments about me into court in the next month or so. I'm in court as an expert witness in the Scottish courts in relation to a case where a submariner died of cancer because of exposure to radiation from the reactor in the submarine. So there we are. That's me.
Okay, Chris. Well, if been a few developments. I spoke to you 6 or 8 months ago about this discovery of what you think is evidence of the use of a neutron weapon by the Israelis in Gaza. Now, if you could just kind of recap on why you think that, and I know that you've got some new evidence to add to it as well.
Yes. Well, I mean, I've been interested in the issue of DU, depleted uranium weapons, ever since they began to be used in the 1990s, first of all in Iraq and then later in the Balkans. So uranium weapons, depleted uranium bullets and so forth were used as an anti-tank weapon in the Balkans and in Kosovo, and there was, of course, it was they were used in the Gulf War, the first Gulf War from 1991, and then the second Gulf War from 2003, and the Americans used them also in Fallujah, and I've done a
Okay,
number
can
of
you just say
studies.
something about what they are, where they come from? Because this is basically nuclear waste, isn't it? But being made into a shell and fired at high velocity.
Yes, well, originally that's what we thought. I mean, in fact, it is what is the situation is that the story was that DU, depleted uranium, is a waste product from the extraction of the enriched uranium, the U-235, from uranium ore. And of course, U-235 is used in nuclear weapons, and it's used in nuclear energy system, nuclear power reactors, and so forth. And so they have these centrifuges that which remove the uranium, which separate the enriched uranium from the uranium that's mined in nature. And so they want to get high levels of U-235, which is the fissile one of the three uranium isotopes that are found in nature. The main one is uranium-238, which is about 99%. And then there's a small amount of U-235, and there's an even smaller amount of U-234. So these are the three natural uranium isotopes. And of course, and so what's left behind once they take out the stuff that they like to make bombs and so forth is basically a waste product. And it was said that when they make them into penetrators, into bullets, because they're so massive and because they burn when they hit something, they burn in oxygen when they hit something, they're very useful for anti-tank weaponry. And in fact, that turns out to be the case. So in the first Gulf War, Saddam's tanks were all blown to pieces by these little bullets, which are about the size of a pencil, in fact, about half a pencil. And they weigh about 300 grams. And they fired from the Gatling guns, from rotating guns under the wings of the American Warthog A-10 aircraft. And so when they hit these tanks, they go right through through the armor of the tank. And then they blow the lid off the tank and they roast everybody inside. I mean, I know this because I've been to Iraq. I went to Iraq and I saw all this stuff. I saw all the carcasses of the tanks and I took a Geiger counters and detectors and so forth and I measured the radiation. And I did the same in Kosovo as well. In 2001, I went to Kosovo and I found depleted uranium dust all over the place. It was believed that this depleted uranium caused cancer and genetic damage, and studies began to show that that was the case. So the children of Gulf War veterans in America, a number of studies showed that they had high levels of congenital malformation. And I myself studied the population of Fallujah, where the Americans had used uranium weapons and found high levels of cancer and high levels of congenital malformations and birth defects shown, and also there was a sex ratio change which showed genetic damage. So,
Well, this is very counterintuitive. I mean, surely the damage is going to be on the Iraqi side. You're not going to get veterans. They're just firing this stuff.
well, they're not just firing; they are just firing stuff, but they're also wandering around the places where this stuff's been fired, you know, and the dust is all over the place, and they inhale the dust. I'm helping a number of veterans in the United States at the moment who are trying to get compensation for all the illnesses they have had, which they believe to be caused by exposure to the depleted uranium dust, which is inhaled and then gets into the body, and causes high local dose inside the body. So that is to say that the radiation effect is very close to the particle, and so if the particle gets lodged in the body, you get a very high radiation damage to the volume around the particle. And the problem is that the military and the governments of the world, they say that it can't do any harm because they dilute all this radiation into much larger volumes. So, you know, the size of organs, and so several kilograms, in fact. So that used to be the area of contention. You know, why is uranium dangerous, and why is depleted uranium dangerous, and so forth. But in 2006, I made a very interesting discovery, and now I'm coming over to talk about what it is that you're interested in with regard to the new weapon. Because in 2006, I obtained some samples from the Lebanon from a bomb crater where the Israelis had dropped a bomb in a place called Qiyam, which is in southern Lebanon, and this crater was radioactive. And it was reported that this crater was radioactive. And to cut a long story short, we obtained some samples from the crater, and I had them analyzed at various two different laboratories in the UK using two different methods. And instead of showing depleted uranium, which is what we were expecting, it showed enriched uranium. And that was pretty astonishing, because why would there be enriched uranium there? Enriched uranium is very expensive. It costs hundreds of thousands of dollars a kilogram, you know, because it takes a lot of work to get it out of the uranium mix. So why would you drop deplete enrich why would you drop enriched uranium on your enemy? There's no explanation.
Okay, well, how do you tell the difference between the two?
You measure the isotopic ratio. So you have various machines that there are three or four different ways of doing this. But the way that it's mostly done nowadays is you use mass spectrometry. So in other words, you take the sample and you put it in a mass spectrometer, and it gets fired through a magnetic field. And of course, the heavier element is twisted less than the lighter element in the magnetic field, rather more. An electric field as well as a charged particle. And you can then measure the number of atoms of uranium-235 and the number of atoms of uranium-238. And then you just divide one by the other and you get the isotopic ratio. Now, the isotopic ratio in nature, that is, stuff that you dig out of the ground, is one atom of U-235 to 138 atoms of U-238. That's what you find in nature. Now, in depleted uranium, it's more like one atom of U-235 to about 400 atoms of U-238, because obviously you've taken out more of the atoms of U-235. That's the fissile one. But in enriched uranium, you get one atom of 235 to 70 or 60 or 50 or 40 atoms of U-238. And so just by doing that, you can tell. The other way to do it is you can do alpha spectrometry. Both of these isotopes, 235 and 238, are alpha emitters. So you can extract them chemically. You can extract the uranium chemically from your soil sample, and you can then measure the alpha energy coming out. And they're different alpha energies for the two isotopes. For 238 and 235 have different alpha energies. So you can count the number of alpha particles. So those are the two main methods that have been used, and they can still be used. And they still are being used. In fact, as I'll come to this in a minute, we have done this with some samples that we obtained with great difficulty from the crater of the bomb used by the Israelis on the in September 2024 to kill the president of Hezbollah, a man called Hassan Nasrallah. And so the Israelis bombed where he was in a bunker underneath the ground in Beirut and killed him. But we heard from somebody who visited this site that the site was slightly radioactive. It's not hugely radioactive, but about 2, 3, 4, 5, in this case, about 10 or 15 times background. But that decays away quite quickly. And this is what we also found with the sample that we got in 2006 from Lebanon. So you get high-ish levels of radioactivity using a Geiger counter, but then over 6 weeks, they die down. Anyway, we managed to get samples from this place. They were collected by a colleague of mine who calls himself Dr. Robert Daly, and who I got to know quite well. He was the chairman of the American Peace Foundation, which is a sort of blog, I guess you'd call it. But it turned out his real name was Dr. Robert Gallagher, Robert L. Gallagher, and he was quite a famous philosopher. He was an international expert on Aristotle, and he wrote lots of books about Aristotle. And he was a really clever, nice, kind person, and I got really friendly with him. But anyway, I managed to persuade him to go and get samples because he was living in Lebanon, and he managed to do that. And he talked to the original person who went in to look to see if the site was radioactive. That was a guy called Dr. Jihad Aboud, and he was the chair, the president of the Lebanese Chemical Society or something. So quite a posh guy. So they went along and they got samples from this site, and they got them to me because it's very difficult to get samples out of Lebanon. So they put them in a bag of coffee. This was an idea we had, and so they were smuggled out by Robert Gallagher's daughter through France, and they were eventually got to me in England at that time. And since then, more samples have been taken, have been smuggled out as coffee. Incidentally, the coffee is very nice. So once we take the samples out of the coffee in their plastic bags, we use the coffee. It's all a bit James Bondish, I think. And actually, in fact, Robert Gallagher was murdered. He was assassinated shortly after the third set of samples were intercepted in Bordeaux by the French customs. And the man who was the courier was bringing those samples to me. I was in France at the time. He gave my name and Robert Gallagher's name to the French authorities. And a few days later, Gallagher was murdered. So that's a very sad story. But anyway, back to the samples. The samples, the first set of samples I got from Robert Gallagher, I managed to get to a colleague in the United States who has a mass spectrometer, a very good one. He's in Texas. And I sent them as a present, a bit like the Maltese Falcon. So I put them inside a present hidden in the Maltese Falcon and posted them to this guy. And he measured the, I was asking him to look for the uranium isotopes. I said, you know, I want to see what the levels of uranium 235 and 238 were. But in the event, the amount of uranium in the samples wasn't really enough for him to do that. But what he did was he looked at the isotopes of lead and the isotopes of mercury and the isotopes of cadmium. Now, in nature, lead has a number of different isotopes. It has its isotopes that have lead 204, lead 206, lead 207, and lead 208. These are the standard isotopes you find if you dig lead out of the ground. And they vary to some extent, depending upon the amount of the amount of uranium because they're all the final products of uranium decay. So there is a sort of ratio that you can find in nature. And the same with mercury. Mercury, the isotopes are 200, 201, and 202. And with cadmium, there's 110, 111, 112, 13, and 14. So these are different isotopes of the same element. But the point is that in nature, the isotopic ratios are pretty fixed. And even with the lead isotopes, they're fixed over a certain region. But what we found when these samples were analyzed, and there were two samples from close to where the bomb fell. They were dust samples. They were picked up with a Hoover, with a little vacuum cleaner, one of those things that you clean out a car with, a battery-operated vacuum cleaner. And I have to say, it's quite hard to get these because the site was controlled by Hezbollah, and they're quite tough guys in Beirut. You know, you have to be quite careful because they'll arrest you and throw you in jail and so on. So we enlisted support. We had some support from a woman there called Yvonne, who's a reporter, and she helped us get the samples. And then, as I said, they were all smuggled out as coffee and all the rest of that stuff, resulting in the death of poor Robert, unfortunately. But there we are. So what this shows is it shows scientifically that the lead and the mercury and the cadmium in the samples were exposed to neutrons, to quite a high level of neutron exposure. Because what happens when you expose an isotope to neutron is it changes its atomic mass. So, for instance, lead 206 goes to lead 207 when you add a neutron. Lead 207 goes to lead 208 if you add a neutron. Lead 206 goes to lead 208 if you add two neutrons, and so on. And the same at cadmium. So we were looking at cadmium 111 and cadmium 114. Now, normally in nature, cadmium 111 is about 12.8% of all cadmium. And 114 is 28.8% of all cadmium. But when we looked at the samples, we found that instead of being 12.8% and 28%, it was about 12.8 and 12.8. So in other words, the cadmium 114 had absorbed neutrons and turned into whatever it turns into, I think thallium. Is it thallium anyway? Another element. So, and the same with lead. So for each one of these things, for the lead, the heaviest isotope, the 208, disappeared. And for the mercury, the heaviest isotope, which is 202, that disappeared. And for cadmium, the heaviest isotope, 114, disappeared relative to 111. Now, this is an extraordinarily important finding because this is for the first time scientific proof that the bomb that produced that that material was a neutron bomb, that there was a high neutron flux. And that, of course, explains the death of Nasrallah, because neutrons go through concrete. You can't hide from neutrons. That's why neutron bombs were invented, because you can get inside a cellar, like, and you have meters of concrete between you and the bomb, and the bomb blast can't hurt you, and the gamma radiation can't hurt you, but the neutrons go straight through the concrete and kill you. And we heard from various people who were reporting about Nasrallah's death, is that he was found pretty much intact but dead. And this is something gets found again and again in reports that doctors send from Lebanon and from Gaza, that people appear to be dying of diseases that they cannot, that they haven't seen before. Not, I said not diseases, but conditions that they have not seen before, and they're unable to explain.
Okay, well, so
But
how do neutrons kill you then?
they kill you in the same way as radiation kills you. They cause ionization in tissue. They get their neutrons are absorbed by low atomic number elements like hydrogen. I mean, you know, it is hydrogen that stops neutrons. Not neutrons actually hit hydrogen and cause ionization. So it's pretty much the same way that all ionizing radiation works. And in fact, neutrons are included in the list of types of ionizing radiation. If in terms of the Hiroshima bomb, you get lots of neutrons from nuclear bombs, you see, from conventional nuclear bombs. These are the ones that produce fallout, produce cesium-137, and you know all that stuff that causes Geiger counters to go mad. And neutrons won't be detected by Geiger counters, because a Geiger counter doesn't contain material that the neutrons are concerned about. It goes straight through the Geiger counter, and it won't show any signal at all. In order to show a signal, you have to have a special detector which has low atomic number, like lithium or beryllium or something like that. And then what happens is that the neutrons hit the lithium and knock an alpha particle out of it, and what you measure is the alpha particle. So they
Right,
kill you in the same
so
way.
yeah, but is it a quick death? Is it would he have died slowly? What, you know, how does it
No,
actually
yeah, what
work?
it does is it, well, yes, that's a very interesting question. And the answer to that, as far as I can make out, is that it kills you instantly. And it does so by destroying your nervous system. I mean, so in other words, it pretty much smashes up everything. But your nervous system is rather important, because you use it to breathe and to think and you know, all sorts of other things that happen inside bodies. And neutrons just stop those. If you've got high enough neutron flux, what happens is that you just die.
Now, I'd imagine that other scientists, maybe Israeli scientists from Dimona, might say, well, there are other explanations for this imbalance that you've discovered in these different isotopes.
Well, they'd have to say it, but there isn't. There isn't. That it's just this is just physics. I mean, there is no. The only possible explanation for the only possible explanation for the lead imbalance would be that if there was no thorium-232, so because the lead isotopes are daughter elements at the end of the series of the three natural decay series, so that you've got three natural decay series on Earth, and that's uranium-238 series, the uranium-235 series, which they call the actinide series, and the thorium-232 series. So each one of these has a decay, and it goes another decay, and then there's another decay, and another decay, and another decay, and another, over various long periods of time, thousands of years. And, well, more than that, actually, hundreds of thousands of years. But the end product of each of these series is a different lead isotope. And the lead isotope that is the end of the thorium-232 series is lead-208. So if you dig up some mud and you find that there's hardly any lead-208 there, the only possible explanation is that there was no thorium-232 there to begin with. But I followed that up because I looked at the concentrations of thorium-232 in actually it's pretty much normal throughout the globe, but it certainly there's a paper or number of papers that show that the thorium-232 levels in Lebanon are pretty normal. So that's not an explanation. The only other explanation, of course, is that somebody brought some material from a nuclear waste site. But then that would have lots and lots of other stuff in it as well, you know. You can't sort of bring just the lead isotopes from a nuclear waste site. The other explanation is that it's material that's been exposed to neutrons somewhere else. For instance, like if they dug up a load of soil right outside a nuclear reactor, it would have various perturbations in the lead. But this isn't the same. This isn't true for the mercury and the cadmium. The cadmium isotope ratios are pretty much constant. They have a variation of less than 1% in all cadmium isotope ratios found on Earth. And
So,
the
I mean,
same.
have you had other scientists in other parts of the world looking at this and assessing it, Chris?
Well, it's only just come out. That's the first thing. I mean, I only released the. I sat on this data for a month or two because I was afraid to be murdered. Okay? I mean, this is hot stuff. And, you know, they killed poor Robert, and I'm hiding out in the forest in Latvia, you know, surrounded by guinea fowl, and hope that nobody's going to kill me because the people who killed Robert are really, you know, quite serious people. And various other people have died who have drawn attention to this issue of the neutron bomb. I mean, there are a number of deaths along the road. The man who wrote the book about the original book about it, called The Mystery of the Three Bullets, that guy, he's dead. And the other guy who wrote it with him was sent three bullets in the mail, and then he disappeared. So I can't get in touch with him. But to answer your question, I can tell you that a friend of mine sent the paper to his physics tutor at Oxford, and the physics tutor at Oxford said he's not. He thought about it for a bit, and he got back and said he's not going to make any comments on it because it's secret stuff. It has to do with, you know, government secrecy. So that's the most that I know about it. But I've sent it to other scientists who say, yeah, sure. A number of scientists that I know, physicists that I know, said, look, this is perfectly clear that this shows neutron exposure effects. Now, we don't know how it works. We don't entirely know how the bomb works. We've got, you know, the device. We've got a sort of idea about it, which we got initially from Emilio Della Guidici, who's was quite a famous physicist, but he's dead. He died suddenly too, and he actually visited me in London. We had a meeting in Paddington in 2006, in which he told me how this thing worked. And so that so we have a rough idea how it worked, but how it produces these alterations in the isotopic ratios, we haven't figured out. I mean, you can do a bit of arm waving, but I don't know enough about. This is high energy atomic physics. I've no doubt there are people who can do this, but I'm not one of them. All
So, I
I can
mean,
say is
let's
that.
just imagine a kind of cannon style bomb where you use conventional explosives to get some kind of nuclear device into deeper into the ground. So I mean, is that what we're looking at here? So some
Yes,
way
I
of
think so.
penetrating the
We're looking
ground
at.
and then something else happens. In other words, the shell kind of goes into the ground and then explodes as it gets down with this neutron effect.
Yes, I think we're looking at something like that. But when I look at the whole picture, going back over my own work on this over 20 years, I realize that I'm an idiot. You know, I realize that actually this stuff's been used for a long, long time. You know, this is nothing new. It's just that what's new is that we've discovered it. But before that, you know, it was being used all over the place. For example, I talked to Saud al-Azawi, who is a quite a famous or well-known Iraqi scientist woman. Last week I talked to her because I'm doing a study in Iraq on uranium effects in southern Iraq, cancer and so forth. And I talked to her because she studied this as well. And she did a load of measurements of uranium in Iraq long ago, before the Second Gulf War. And if you look at her results, which she sent to me, you find that there's enriched uranium in Iraq before the Second Gulf War. And you think, excuse me, Guten Morgen. So this weapon was used long ago. It's been used long ago. She said to me that she thought that this was the weapon that was used to kill all of Saddam's his guards who were defending the Baghdad airport at the time of the Second Gulf War, because they were all found in their trenches dead. But there was no reason for them being dead. And people who at the time who I met and told me about this when I was in Malaysia, talking about uranium, they told me that that the report was that there were a lot of big flashes, and then the next day all of these people in their dugouts, sheltered behind concrete, were dead, but with no apparent reason for them being dead. So I think this is a tunable weapon, and it's pretty much like Del Guidici said, you can make, once you've got the technology, you can produce as many neutrons as you like, or you can produce no neutrons. You can make anything from just an ordinary DU bullet that goes bam through a tank to something like a sort of super DU bullet that contains hydrogen and burns its way through the tank and produces neutrons, or you can make something pretty much close to a nuclear weapon, which I think is what Israel has done and is what they're using. And it drives the
Well,
coach and horses through all of these nuclear bomb treaties that everybody has signed all over the
it's
place,
not just that, is it? What we keep hearing about is the inspections of Iran and their civil nuclear program, but we don't hear anything about the Israelis. But look, there's another development also this week, Chris, which is to do with underground dumping. Ed Miliband is poised to overrule local opposition to build nuclear waste dumps in Cumbria, particularly. I mean, this surely is, it's been going on for decades, this threat to sort of tunnel down, a bit like the BBC series The Edge of Darkness, and to sort of get waste into the ground and then just basically seal it up and forget about it, rather than to have it contained on the surface and to deal with it like that. So it looks as if Miliband is going to be pushing this ahead, with saying, well, actually, even if the locals don't want it, then we're going to do it anyway.
Well, I know an awful lot about the disposal of nuclear waste in this way, because I was commissioned by the Swedish anti-nuclear people to write a big report about the Forsmark repository, which actually has been allowed to go ahead now. And there was a big court case, which I was involved in as well, in Stockholm, in the Nacka court, the Nacka Environmental Court, in which we argued that what they were proposing was astonishingly awful and dangerous, But in fact, in the end, what happened in Sweden is that the government overruled the findings of the Nacka court. The environmental court said, you can't do this. And they said, well, stuff you, we're going to go ahead and do it. So they overruled the Nacka court. And so they're building this exact repository, the one that Miliband is talking about, out under the Baltic Sea, near the Forsmark site in Sweden, about north of Uppsala. So the answer the answer is that they mustn't do this. I mean, what can we say? All we can do is bleat, and all the local people can bleat and do bleat, and the government, like in England, just like the government in Sweden, can just go ahead and say, "Well, stuff you, we're going to
Well,
do
yeah, but
it."
it's got to go somewhere, surely.
It stays where it is. It's packaged and repackaged and repackaged. The nuclear-free local authorities think that. I suggested that long ago when the question came up. Is that all you can do with this stuff? I mean, I made a video about it, God knows how long ago. Is that all you can do with this stuff is to repackage it? So you just leave it above ground in a sort of big hangar. You guard it so nobody can steal it. I don't know why anybody would want to. And then you just, if it looks like it's going to leak, you put another package around the package. And my suggestion, which I thought rather entertaining at the time, and I still believe this is the best way, is to actually have people who are given a job, and you could say it's a job that goes down through time. So your son gets it, and his son gets it, and so on. and you call yourselves guardians of the nuclear waste, and you get a special outfit, you know, with sort of badges and stuff like that, and golden buttons. And people say, oh, do you know Jim? That Jim's father is a guardian of the nuclear waste. And he said, no, surely not. Oh, yes, yes. And he gets a lot of money, and he's got this uniform, and he walks about guarding the nuclear waste. I think that's the only safe way to do it. If you once you stick it in the ground, all sorts of things happen. I mean, Neil, I had a geology friend, a professor, what was he called? Niels Morgan something. He's dead now, in Sweden. He said that you get geological movements which will destroy any attempt to keep this stuff from the environment once you've buried it. I mean, over geological timescales, there are movements which will destroy any integrity to this sort of nuclear site.
So if Miniban was with us now, Chris, what would you have to say to him?
I would say you're an ignoramus. I'd say the problem with people like you is that you're politicians and you just don't know any science. And what you do is you surround yourselves with scientists who work for the nuclear industry and idiots, and they will tell you what it is you want to know.
And whereabouts are groups like Friends of the Earth on all this?
Well, Friends of the Earth were behind the work that I did in Sweden. I don't know what Friends of the Earth are doing now, and I don't know what Greenpeace is doing now. Those people, Friends of the Earth and Greenpeace, I have no time for them. All they do is they ask people for money.
So where's the best place to follow your work, Chris, for listeners?
Well, at the moment, I just basically Google is the best place to follow my work. If you're interested in something, ask the question and add Chris Busby to the question, and you'll find something that I've said on it somewhere. Whenever I do a study, I put it on Facebook, on my Facebook site, which was Chris Busby 714. And if you go through that, you'll find pretty much everything I do as I do it. And I also put it out on my Twitter. Is that what they call it now? X Twitter site, which is called at Christo Busby, capital C, capital B, at Christo Busby. So when I publish something, I just stick it out on at Christo Busby. And I also put everything on researchgate.net. So you can find me on researchgate.net. You can find me on academia.edu. And all my stuff is on there too. And I have to say, I'm doing pretty well at the moment, producing lots of papers and causing a lot of havoc amongst the ungodly.
Chris Busby, thanks very much for joining us again.
Very welcome, Tony.